Hello, Radio World. I'm Casey, your host for the next hour, and welcome to another episode of Movieland here on CITR 101.9 FM. Last time I said I would maybe delve into Raymond Chandler's rich, hard-boiled noir detective world and the Hollywood dream machine, but something really sad happened in the world this past week. David Bowie died. It will be one of those celebrity deaths that I will always remember, weighted with an indescribable significance of my own mortality at the time of his. And I remember the first one of these vicarious public deaths that I experienced was Princess Diana. I was 11, and my memory of that whole period was cloudy at best. My own vague ideas about beauty, sex, and fame were slowly being shaped at the time of her scandal. I remember a 2020 episode with Barbara Walters, a tapped phone sex conversation, her really beautiful suits and amazingly masculine haircut, her humanitarian work, her cute sons, her fairy tale life, and then suddenly her dark and mysterious lover in a car in a tunnel trying to escape the tabloids, and then smash. Everything about that was so movie narrative driven and made so legitimately public because it was news that maybe that's why very few attempts at a biopic have been made, and the ones that have been made have been bad. And then there was Michael Jackson, which was so shocking because you felt as if you were watching an unliving, not dead, but unalive puppet for the last stretch of his life anyway. And more recently, the deaths that stung me a little bit to a lot, Lauren Bacall, Chris Marker, Robin Williams, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Chantal Ackerman. When Chantal Ackerman died, I was sitting in my kitchen with my elbows on the table looking at my phone over a fresh cup of tea. And in that split second of realizing that she had died over like an Instagram post, I yelped and dropped my phone into the full cup of tea and then immediately yanked it out. Like if you've ever put your hand accidentally on a hot element or a kettle or something, it was that quick of a response. And I don't know how, but the suction gravity science of dropping something with an open bottom, like the phone charger hole, into liquid made it so that my phone lived somehow. Like I didn't even soak it in rice or anything. I just put it down on the table on a cloth and let it drain. I mean, Siri got fried a little bit and was acting really weird, but once she dried out, she somehow made sense again. And I like to believe that Chantal Ackerman's spirit saved my phone, like any mundane comfort to ease the death of a great artist who you only knew on that abstract, removed, imagined level, like through their art. And any connection to that is something worth holding on to, I guess. So yeah, Chantal Ackerman is still alive in my phone. And when Bowie died, I was at work that night in a restaurant. It was the end of a very calm night, and I'd been in a pretty bad mood all weekend, just kind of grumpy and tired and bored more so than usual. I was in my head a lot, you know, I was like thinking about life as an artist, how long and wherefore and who and why and blah blah blah, you know. So anyway, I'm sitting at the bar, I finished my cash out, and I go on my phone and look at Instagram, and it took me 3 Bowie photos with captions of, 1, an emoji heart, 2, an emoji teardrop, and then the final confirmation, a caption that read, "This one hurts." I announced it out loud to my coworker behind the bar, "David Bowie died," and as I was saying it, it felt like there was no right tone to say it in. There was no real reason to even say it, like give anyone 5 minutes on the internet or access to their phone. The futility of that really struck hard. I felt silly for caring to share this information as if it were personal to me. But it is personal. It is deeply personal in ways difficult to articulate. Maybe the most difficult ever to articulate, because David Bowie was like nothing else, hey? And there have been many posts honoring the memory of Bowie, and here's one I really liked that I saw on Facebook from 2013. It's a dinner speech Tilda Swinton gave on Bowie at the opening of his Victoria and Albert Museum exhibition in the form of a letter addressed to David Bowie. And in it, she describes her formative experience with artists. She says, "When I was 12 and a square sort of kid in a round pond kind of childhood, not far from here, I carried a copy of Aladdin Sane around with me. For a full 2 years before I had the wherewithal to play it, the image of that gingery, bony, pinky, whitey person on the cover with the liquid mercury collarbone was, for one particular young moonage daydreamer, the image of planetary kin, of a close imaginary cousin and companion of choice. It's taken me a long time to admit, even to myself, let alone you, that it was the vision and not yet the sound that hooked me up. But if I can't confess that here and now, then where and when? We all have our own roots and routes to this room. That really hit me, her confession that it was the vision first and then the sound that initially instinctually grabbed her. And me too, it was the image first. What I think she's saying is that popular culture labels Bowie as a rock musician, a glammy art rock star, but actually above all else, he is an artist, a contemporary artist working in the medium of popular music, of entertainment. She put it also poetically, ending it by calling Bowie every alien's favorite cousin, certainly mine. And we have a nice life.
Like friends? Well, we like you. So become a member and get a Friends of CITR card. Not only does it make you special, it gets you all kinds of deals with our friends downtown, like 10% off at Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Studio Records, Community Thrift and Vintage, The Fall Tattooing, and more. Visit CITR.ca for more, or come check us out in the Nest.
Do you like Friends? Well, we like you. So become a member and get a Friends of CITR card. Not only does it make you special, but it gives you all kinds of deals with our friends on Main Street, including 10% off at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Red Cat Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and more. Visit CITR.ca for more, or come check us out in the Nest.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Movie Land. Before the break, I just played David Bowie's Sound and Vision off of his album Low from 1977. Low and Station to Station from 1976 both have stills from the film The Man Who Fell to Earth as the cover art, starring Bowie himself as the eponymous Man Who Fell to Earth. The film was made by British director Nicholas Roeg and released in 1976. What was supposed to be the soundtrack to the film itself was turned into these albums. What happened was that the studio and producers felt that Bowie's score wasn't accessible enough. That, and it wasn't what Roeg had in mind. Listening to both albums, I can see why they wouldn't have worked exactly for the film in how it exists today, but if edited differently, maybe. It would have definitely had a more extreme pace, maybe too much music video vibe. Like imagining Station to Station tracking the opening scene of the film as Bowie Alien makes his way through the desert. This whole decade, the 1970s, is known as Bowie's golden years, and some mythical, mystical things were reported to have happened during the shooting of the film involving the color gold. There was a lot of equipment malfunction, cameras jamming for no reason, and then Bowie got sick for a few days after drinking some bad milk. He said he saw some gold liquid swimming around in shiny swirls inside the glass. According to the Bowie Golden Years website, Bowie is still to this day unsure of what actually happened. No trace of any foreign element was detected in tests, though there were six eyewitnesses who said they had seen the strange matter at the bottom of the glass. Already in an extremely fragile state, Bowie felt the whole location had a very bad karma. Also adding to the weird energy was the amount of cocaine he was doing at the time. Cocaine, cigarettes, and milk made the thin white Duke. The film is shot and set mostly in New Mexico, the state with its own gold rush history in the 1800s, and it begins in a kind of western aesthetic. The spaceman Bowie alien crash lands, and the first thing he does is drink some water, and then visit a pawn shop to sell his gold wedding ring to a very local-looking old woman. As the vanguard of old-timey America, she eyes him wearily, suspiciously, this ginger-haired vampire holding a British passport.
Are you the first?
The first what? Visitor? I've always been visited.
Nothing you have seen or heard about David Bowie will prepare you for the impact of his first dramatic performance in The Man Who Fell to Earth. This is another dimension of David Bowie, one of the few true originals of our time.
You're really a freak. I don't mean that unkindly. I like freaks.
Is this a weapon?
A weapon?
Well, it's too small for interplanetary travel.
So you assume that it's a weapon? If I stay here, I shall die.
What do you mean? Take me with you. I'll see you don't die.
I can't stay.
You're an alien!
I think you know too much about me.
Where are you taking me?
He's just like everybody else. He's a fake.
Please don't do it. You don't understand.
You might be able to save him.
Mary Lou!
Save him?
Help me!
From what?
Fell to Earth is a powerful love story, a cosmic mystery, a spectacular fantasy, a shocking, mind-stretching experience in sight, in space, and sex.
That was the trailer. As you might be able to guess. And the trailer, it's very misleading. Trailers usually are, right? Like, it's trying to capitalize on titillating the audience, obviously. And watching it, I'm expecting something full of suspense, action, sex. And although the film has those things in it, it presents them in kind of a distanced, different way. Like, for all of the sex in the film, I found it totally unsexy. The sound mixing took me out of the verisimilitude and put me in the dubbing studio. I'm just imagining some studio execs taking a rough cut of the film to a trailer editor, maker, artist, whatever, and saying, "Here, make this appeal to everyone," and missing the point entirely. So I'm just going to give a quick synopsis of the film. It's based on a 1963 Walter Tevis novel of the same name, and the plot follows an alien creature named Thomas Jerome Newton, played by Bowie, who crash lands on Earth and takes on a striking human form. He quickly adapts to the ways of society, and with the help of a patent lawyer, Farnsworth, played by Buck Henry, he uses his far advanced space whiz technology to become an overnight billionaire through his company, World Enterprises Corporation. There's a really great scene in the beginning of the film where Bowie Alien visits Farnsworth at his house for a meeting, and he presents him with these papers full of equations. And Farnsworth, he's wearing these like bug-eyed bifocal glasses. He looks super cute, and he's kind of skeptical, kind of like, "Oh yeah, I'll look at them and call you back tomorrow." And Bowie refuses to leave, so Farnsworth just looks at them for a few minutes and snaps his head up and says, "Do you know what these are?"
"I don't believe it. I can't believe it. You have 9 basic patents here. 9. That's basic patents. Do you know what that means?"
"Yes, I think so."
"Do you really? I wonder. It means, Mr. Newton, that you can take RCA, Eastman Kodak, and DuPont for starters."
"In, say, 3 years, what would this be worth to me?"
I'm a lawyer, not an accountant, Mr. Newton. But I'd say it must be something in the area of $300 million.
"Not more."
"More?
I need more."
"What the hell for?"
He then goes back to New Mexico, where he first landed, stays at a nearby hotel, and becomes romantically involved with a bell girl, Mary Lou, played by Candy Clark. The two shack up while he learns about humans through television and drinking and being with her. And we learn that his plans are to develop his own space program so he can bring water back to his planet to save his family. But years pass, and his goals fade in human time. He becomes stagnant through his vices. He is betrayed by his chemistry technician, Nathan Bryce, played by Rip Torn, and by Mary Lou, gets captured by the government and is held captive as a test subject, and in the end fails his mission to save his planet and becomes a musician in hopes that his wife from another space-time might be able to hear his songs. And his album's called The Visitor. On a side note, in the similar vein of 70s genre mashing with sci-fi as an entry point, there's a film called The Visitor starring John Huston, made in 1979 by Giulio Paradisi, which has a similar aesthetic to The Man Who Fell to Earth, but is even more weird and farther reaching than The Man Who Fell to Earth. It's worth watching for its bizarreness and its total sci-fi, horror, gallo film mashup. Anyway, back to The Man Who Fell to Earth. In the end, it is a 2-hour and 18-minute film that it's a bit of work to watch. For me, it was anyway. It's very full, very dense, with a lot of things happening, but much of the action occurs elliptically, like years will pass unannounced with an ordinary cut. We're not cued to expect such a jump, and suddenly a character's hairline has receded a good 10 years, and this happens quite a lot. There is a lot of visual bridging, and a certain attentiveness and sensitivity is required to really appreciate the film. It is definitely a film that is better the second time around, as there are so many details. It never achieves a flow in a narrative sense. The plot is, as critics have pointed out, very fluffy and at times incoherent and just plain unbelievable. It's not packed with sci-fi terminology or special effects. It's banal, it's moody, it's meditative. It's a meditation about science fiction rather than a sci-fi film, plain and simple, reflecting on humanity's doomed repetitions that maybe actually are universal, as the spaceman proves to be just a man at the end of it all, tired with a drink in his hand. In terms of filmmaking, I haven't seen anything else by Nicholas Roeg yet, but I really felt a distinct collagist style of editing. The trailer sets this up really badly, but viewers have to be in the right headspace to catch the hints of a backstory that otherwise goes unrevealed, at least explicitly, for much of the film. Roeg has a very bold, cutting sensibility, mashing up disparate genres and visually matching events happening in two different places to create a comparative irony. This happens a few times. One scene is made up of two scenes actually having a conversation that only we, the viewer, are privy to. For instance, Newton, our beloved Bowie alien, at one point is watching a Japanese sword fight in a restaurant while he's eating, and this is cut with Nathan Bryce as a gross, womanizing chemistry professor.
Hello.
Ugh, so gross. Having sex with a succession of young students taking photos of the lovemaking using an instant camera made by World Enterprise Corporation. In another scene, Roeg basically uses film to capture a collagist video art aesthetic, a personal favorite of mine, what contemporary filmmaker, artist, and philosopher Hito Steil would call the poor image. The scene is Bowie Alien and Mary Lou having a domestic spat, ending with her abruptly yelling at him to have a serious talk. She's in tears, standing in front of a wall of 16 TVs that he turns on to drown her out. I'll play it for you. It has a very beautiful Roy Orbison track in the background, too, to add to the sweet sonic cacophony of it all.
Not your color, it's blue.
No.
It's exactly the same style.
No.
Damn it!
No, I don't like it.
All right, well, I'll send it back. I've had enough.
I don't want to talk to anyone.
Tommy. Tommy, what's happened to you?
What's happened to me? What is this music Farnsworth keeps sending me? I don't like it.
Some giant composer.
I like to hear people singing. Let's have singing. Find some singing.
People sing.
I feel so bad, I've got a worried mind.
Let's talk.
I'm so lonesome all the time.
Oh, don't since turn on those damn TVs. Come on, Tommy. Talk to me. I can't stand what's happening to you, whatever it is. Why did you just tell me?
Sun don't shine.
I hate it.
Since you know the alphabet, and since this is the first day of class,
We will begin by speaking to ourselves.
If you have nothing to say, the sentence of the court will be carried out.
No, I'm looking for you, baby.
So, we modify our body and our engine and use someone who didn't weigh much to drive. And we got 84 miles to go.
Rock! This man is completely insane! That's what...
Alone.
By authority of His Gracious Majesty, George Rex.
I'm putting the stick. Stay where you belong. Go away. Back where you belong.
God bless Captain Fear.
Back where you came from.
What we are seeing here is Bowie Alien subjecting himself to Clockwork Orange-type torture, the torture of images of the poor image mediated through a tiny screen, through 16 tiny screens, video data that is compressed, interlaced, decontextualized, and recontextualized, flattened through the narrative world of the film itself, on film itself, through the idea of collectively watching it in a theater, like with other Bowie fans, but in the end, in a digital, downloaded AVI format on my laptop screen, into my brain, and through time, out of my mouth, here to you over the radio waves. It's like figuring out how many times removed a distant relative is. Like, how meta can we get here? So Rogue's presentation of the poor image, the collage, the flattening of visual culture into information to be learned is one way to really enjoy the film, for me at least. He really successfully collapses cinema history and then the relatively young ubiquitous medium of television into the film form. The imagined scenes of Bowie Alien's family and home planet are so abstract and theatrical that they function simultaneously as flashbacks, hallucinations, a reality of them waiting for him, dreams, or any other space-time existence you want. And Rogue nods to various genres of filmmaking too, like the Western in the beginning, the film noir, pornography, romantic comedies, melodrama, mystery, and all of it has this dated 70s feel of gala films like Dario Argento, much to do with the lushly colored sets, the unnaturalistic dubbing and sound design, and the artless reveal of the plot, which in this film is not an art, but a device.
Dummy, look, a train. I like trains. I remember when Mama used to put us on a train. I was about 10. And we'd go to Oklahoma City to visit Granny. The trains were really nice then. They had concession stands, and they would sell magazines and candy bars and sodas. And then about 6 years later, I rode the train again, and the concession stands were gone. There weren't too many people on the train. There weren't any dining cars, and the seats were all shabby. It's a shame. I used to like trains.
And the song that was playing is called Try to Remember by the Kingston Trio. What I love about Bowie in this film is that it is both a simple and complex presentation of an artist who at that point already had a long history in popular culture. There are a lot of meaningful lines that can be read if one is a Bowie fan, like when Mary Lou scolds him for being too thin, not eating enough, or when she calls him a freak. Bowie is Bowie, alien is Bowie. It's not so much acting as it is a performance of himself. And at one point, Mary Lou and Bowie, alien, fight, and he whacks a tray of cookies she is holding, and they fly into the air in slow motion, suddenly reminding the viewer of 2001 A Space Odyssey, whose main character, David Bowman, is the origin of David Robert Jones's persona as David Bowie. One of his most famous quotes is, "I don't have stylistic loyalty. That's why people perceive me changing all the time. But there's a real continuity in my subject matter. As an artist of artifice, I do believe I have more integrity than any one of my contemporaries." And I wonder about what that means. See, I understand his subject matter, and I understand his art of artifice. But what I wonder about, the real mystery to Bowie for me is that integrity in relation to continuity. To me, that is a question of character, and what we'll never know about him, actually. Integrity is something of depth behind the artifice, and he really never gives that to us, but we somehow know it's there. Like, he is always so in control in his interviews. He uses his cunning and guile, but straight on, unwavering, unflinching, holding court with those eyes, looking you straight in the eyes. I'm going to play this awesome YouTube supercut called David Bowie Gets Annoyed, and it's 7 minutes of pure Bowie, so enjoy.
I just wonder if you get tired of being outrageous.
I don't think I'm outrageous at all.
Are you there, David Bowie?
Yes.
Last time we met on the air, you were sitting in this studio at this side, and you had a very elegant earring hanging from either your left or right ear. I can't remember. Do you remember that?
How are you, Russell? It's nice to see you.
But I'm very happy to present to you this golden record for your tremendous LP, Low.
Well, let's
take it this way.
I want to look at it.
Well, you want to look at it. All right, take it.
Well, don't ask me that question. I cannot believe you asked me that question.
No? Why not?
Do you believe you actually asked me that question?
Well,
you're keeping something.
I've answered the question.
Right, okay.
You were really the point man for challenging a lot of social attitudes and sexual attitudes in the 70s.
Oh, rubbish.
Now, you just finished making the film called The Man Who Came to Earth.
Fell to Earth.
Fell to Earth, I beg your pardon.
Critics have claimed that you are more ideas.
You are the bossy maniac.
You describe yourself as ordinary. What adjective would you use?
David Bowie.
We're talking about films and filmmaking. One of the people I presume you would have liked to have worked with would have been Piero Pasolini.
Would I?
Well, look, there's a million things I could ask you, and I can't go on.
Well,
before there's one question, David. Don't you deal with it anymore.
You know, also, since you've been away, or quite recently, the newspapers have been having a bit of a bash at your mother. And saying that she's a bit tearful from time to time, and that she's suffering a certain amount of anguish, and that she doesn't hear from you an awful lot. Is that eyewash, or is it real?
That's really my own business.
And that's how it's going to stay, is it?
Yes.
Well, I'm reluctant to make the judgment about what category you fit into, and I'm hoping that you would say. Well, no, I wouldn't be that pretentious, but maybe you have a feeling yourself.
That in the 60s you felt that bands had a really immediate feel. Mm. Do you think that you've managed to recreate that?
No.
Okay, now, what I wanted to say, as soon as you're outside of the protected
area...
Yeah,
I got the question.
You're in.
No. No.
Do you know that the pop scene at this end, the pop world has changed somewhat since you left?
No. No.
Have you heard of the Bay City Rollers?
Yes.
Well, you know that they're appealing to a kind of large, mass hysterical audience of young people
yes.
who wave a lot of stuff around. Now, I wonder what kind of audience you're going to come back to face.
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm thinking in a kind of way. You may have to create a whole new scene for yourself.
No.
Do you want to be understood? You know what I mean? That Ziggy Stardust was concerned with famine in the world and so on, and prophecies of the world running out of...
For someone who claims not to be all that good a musician, why are you coming back to perform on stage? Or are you a better musician, in fact, than you admit?
I can't link those two parts. If I'm not that good a musician, why am I coming back?
Yes. Yes.
Does this make you nervous to sit without your band and with everything and just to chat a little bit?
Let's carry on talking. Don't ask me that.
What colour is your hair?
Which bit?
The centre bit at the top, above where your nose would be.
Well, what colour does it look?
Well, it looks like a bit of something out of the end of Straw Dogs.
Something out of the end of Straw Dogs.
But he and she's you've loved in your time, haven't you?
So I've read.
Well, I've only heard two, but it was you've been asked the question whether you're bisexual or not.
Too many times.
Yes, and you've never quite answered it.
Oh, I have. I said I was bisexual, that's enough.
Mm.
You said you don't feel yourself a hero.
No.
People make you a hero.
No, they don't.
For them.
No, they don't.
What if
they don't make me a hero. I know I'm not a hero.
What is the power of still going on? Doing it. Doing...
Nope.
Making records, selling.
Yeah. That's work.
Just work.
Yeah.
What are you looking for at this moment? What are you searching for?
Liquid. Treetop apple juice.
Is it good? Would you spit some across the satellite?
No.
You're keeping something.
I've answered the question.
Right, okay.
Bits and pieces I used to do many years ago, like painting, writing, spending free time with myself and my family, getting out of cities.
And relaxing a lot.
No, not relaxing.
No.
No. No. That's really my own business. No.
Is there a leader in your group?
Yes, quite definitely. I am the leader.
Are you? You are the boss of Egomaniac.
I mean, you're equipped with fame, you're equipped with a certain amount of fortune, you're equipped with, I presume, the kind of advisors who will give you good advice, and therefore you're not like a girl or a boy sitting in a basement in Notting Hill struggling to get into some kind of proper situation, who wants to be an actor, who wants to be a film star, who wants to get onto the scene.
I was, though.
I don't know where you read that, but that's not true. No, but that's not true.
I don't think I would like to get into that over a 20-minute interview.
You wouldn't?
When I come back to England, I would talk to you about that, yes.
All right.
At length.
How calculated is any of this? That's bollocks. Bollocks.
I can...
Well, it doesn't have to be that one-sided, does it?
Aren't
you going to contribute?
A little bit, yes. I'm worming away by expensive satellites. No,
okay.
Very excited that you're here this evening. Marvellous band, a marvellous new album that we're going to be hearing.
I had a good night's viewing planned, so we run a bit late, so
do you want me to
brush
this, get through.
Yeah, let's get this done.
Okay.
Well, David, we're coming towards the end of our too brief conversation.
Oh, that's a shame.
I think that's going to be enough, because I can't go on. I just can't go on badly.
Hello, I'm Wilson.
I'm Permita.
You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Happy 75th birthday, CITR.
CITR 101.9 FM. It's what the whales are talking about.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
Casey here, and today I'm talking about the beautiful, recently passed David Bowie, specifically in the film The Man Who Fell to Earth by Nicholas Roeg. Here is a scene from the film, one of the very unsexy love scenes between Bowie Alien and Mary Lou.
That's the way I am. It's too late, Mary Lou. I can't trust you.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Goodbye, Mary Lou.
No.
Sleep
no!
well!
No! Mary Lou. Won't they come Goodbye. In the noise?
So
oh, no!
No, they gave me the gun, the blanks, and I asked for them, and I asked for you, and here you are. They're not really giving me anything. I'm paying. I'm rich. I can afford anything. Yes.
Oh, please.
Yes,
oh, please, all noble sire.
Hello.
Oh, that's gold.
Now, goodbye, sweet Mary Lou. I'm so in love with you. Yes.
Oh, don't you.
So hello, Mary Lou. Goodbye. Yes.
The superficiality of that scene, and of his performance, and of his persona, is him at his greatest. As that artist of artifice, he fits perfectly into the film, exploring deeply that artifice, existing deeply inside of it, withholding deeply from within it. The role of an alien, an outsider, a visitor, resonates with Bowie already in his own history as Ziggy, as Aladdin Sane. Those personas he had taken on and fully realized in elaborate costumes, makeup, stage concepts, touring shows, and photo shoots. The mystery of who David Bowie is as a person, as a father, and a husband is not so interesting to me. How he has presented his existence, his many identities publicly is enough, more than enough. It's volumes and volumes of an ideal of power, and of a spiritual quest through art and music. David Bowie in this film does not read as an actor or a movie star. I don't find his performance particularly moving or his love scene sexy. He is cold and unreachable in a way that echoes his public persona. In the film, he is trying to relate to people who want something from him that he cannot give. And he goes through the motions of human interaction, but in the end, both humanity fails him, and he fails the humanity within himself. For a film so strange and instantiating, I was struck by my sympathy for Bowie as Bowie alien as Bowie in the last scene, as he hangs his head down behind that sad brown hat and the credits roll. I am going to end today with a song off of my favorite Bowie album, Scary Monsters, from 1980. Not Ashes to Ashes, because that would be too obvious, but something more inspiring. A soaring song that starts again just when you think it's about to end. And here is to an artistic life of integrity, station to station, to my favorite alien. This is Casey, and this was another episode of Movieland. Check out the Tumblr, movieland.tumblr.com for old episodes and other nuggets. And next week, I will be back and maybe continue on the Raymond Chandler train. That's it, Radio World. Goodbye for now.